This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So in keeping with a now decades-long theme, there probably won't be a lot of change in Utah after the election. But there does seem to be a lot of shifting at the margins of the political scene. That's one of the things that came up in our conversation about the election season this week. We gathered together our usual group of observers to talk. Sean Higgins and Sage Miller of KUER News, Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune, and the senior political scientist David Magleby. We wanted to ask what Utahns think of Donald Trump, whether there are any truly competitive races, whether the growing number of independent candidates means that some kind of challenge is coming for the political establishment. We learned that change may be coming, but not just yet. David Magleby went first.
Well, I think we are and will remain a one-party state coming out of the 2024 election, but I think there are some interesting dynamics underway. One is the write-in campaign of Phil Lyman and the question of how much of the vote will he get, and could it mean that Cox wins re-election with less than a majority of the popular vote. Then I also think the same question is related to Trump and what his margin will be in Utah. I sense a little less visibility on the Trump campaign, at least in Provo, fewer signs. I'm not sure what to make of that. There are political scientists who study signage as an indicator. This is not a random sample by any means, but it's just a sense. And then the question of how can Democrats try to compete? We've got some examples of people running as independents, that is for the legislature, in hopes of doing a little better than they would do if they were nominally Democrat. I doubt that that's going to work. But the Nebraska Senate race may provide a prototype for Democrats as they look to the next race against Mike Lee.
Well, we're going to get to all those sort of major points, I think, as we go. What about the rest of you? Robert Gerke, you want to jump in? What are you seeing and thinking about right now?
Yeah, I think when we talk about change in the state, there's regular time, geologic time, and political time. it's gradual, and you know, it's I think there's a potential for Democrats to make some inroads in Salt Lake County in some of the legislative races, but we still see at the top of the ticket at the statewide races, you know, Brian King is a pretty good candidate, and you know, and still is a long, long shot to, you know, make this race even competitive. So, yeah, I mean, it is, as David said, we are going to remain a one-party state by and large, but it's these little things that might be bubbling under the surface, I think, that maybe are worth watching in this election in particular.
I'm not necessarily looking at who wins. I'm looking at how much did they win by. So I'm more focused on the margins if the gap is shrinking. Like, I agree with Magleby. I agree with Gerke that this election is going to remain Republican in a lot of these large races. There's a few competitive, especially in Salt Lake County. But something that I found pretty interesting, and that also kind of depends on if you agree with the Utah Debate Commission's polling to get somebody on the stage, but that there has been more third-party candidates participating in these debates, which I haven't necessarily seen before. And I'm not thinking that they are going to win, but I do think that they could garner some votes. And I wonder what that shows about the shifting political nature of Utah's landscape. And Sean and I have talked to many voters. We did a voter panel and we asked them, like, where do you see Utah politically in 5 or 10 years? And unequivocally, even a very strong Republican said purple. So this is more so, I think, a marginal – this election will show a marginal shift in the political direction of Utah, not like an overwhelming shift. It's not – I don't think the election results are going to shock anybody, but I do think some of them will be pretty telling.
Marginal shift, you agree?
I will also be hitching my cart to that horse. In that, in the short term, Utah will look the same as it has for the past many election cycles. I do think that when you do look at some of kind of the meta trends in Utah, it'll be interesting to dive into the margins and some of the data when we do have vote counts of which candidate's messaging was resonating most with which type of people. Because when you look at the demographics of the state, we are the youngest state per capita in the nation by quite a bit. A quarter of our population is between the ages of 18 and 30, but less than half of them vote, at least voted in 2022. So as those people age more into becoming more civically minded and casting votes? Does the state shift politically there? There is some data to suggest that people in the Gen Z millennial generation are definitely more progressive than older generations, more so than is kind of the typical when you're young, you're liberal, when you're older, you're conservative, that kind of trend. They're kind of seem to even be bucking that trend. So I think in the short term, Utah will be Utah. But like Sage was saying, on that 5 to 10 year horizon, there could be some interesting changes. I won't necessarily go so far to say that Utah will be turning purple because of more liberals being here. I think it'll be more people who are in that moderate stance becoming more and more the majority.
So it seems like the moderate stance is the thing that has somewhat distinguished Utah, because it seems like the question we're constantly asking is Utah in some way unique in its, you know, political inclinations and its behavior? Sean, I wanted to ask you about something you had mentioned. The national rhetoric that you're hearing is different from the rhetoric you might be hearing in Utah. Like, you know, let's say Trump throwing red meat to the sort of MAGA base. What are you hearing in terms of the rhetoric here? There's no point in spending any money on ads, obviously, if you're Kamala Harris or Donald Trump. But what's the rhetoric like? Are you detecting anything there?
I think it's interesting to draw a contrast between the rhetoric we hear in the GOP primary and the rhetoric we hear in a general. I think just looking back at the Senate race, for instance, you had that four-way GOP primary. There was a lot of red meat thrown around in that race. But looking back at the Senate debate last week, you had one candidate who was to the right of John Curtis, the Republican nominee, and you had one candidate who was clearly to the left, and the Democrat, Caroline Gleick. And from the two major party candidates, they were really not going toward the divisive rhetoric you hear from the national stage. You had a little bit of that from Gleick because she is running against a very popular sitting congressman in John Curtis. But as far as the red meat stuff, I'm not hearing much of it, even in these congressional races that are a little bit smaller and a little bit more hyper-focused.
We've talked about it on the show before. Do Utahns buy into Trumpism? And the data would indicate many do, yes. Trump is still going to win the state, but he always underperforms in this state, especially when you look at some of the other states that where he does well. In 2020, he got 58% of the vote, which, you know, that's a pretty large margin, but it was the worst performance by a Republican since Goldwater in 1960. So
he got 46% in 2016.
In a three-way race.
In a three-way race, but he boosted his number in 2020 by like nearly 30%.
Yeah, I think that has a lot to do with McMullen not being in the race, because Evan McMullen running as an independent gave people a third choice. And that's something we can talk about here, too, is there are a lot of candidates running this year as independents, kind of trying to replicate this McMullen model and win some legislative seats further down the ticket. But the other thing I wanted to mention, and we can get into the governor's race, I guess, but
we will,
is it makes it a little bit curious watching Spencer Cox twisting himself into pretzels on what to do with Donald Trump, right? He was a never-Trumper, and then he endorsed Donald Trump. Then he went to this campaign event that wasn't a campaign event at Arlington Cemetery. And, you know, it's a strange political dance he's doing that we see a lot of Republicans doing with the Trump phenomenon. It strikes me that this endorsement of Trump is not something that's necessarily going to help him in the margin, in the final margins, but it does shore up his right flank a little bit against this write-in campaign that David mentioned that Phil Lyman's running.
David Magley, what do you think? Trump gets 46% in 2016. He gets 58%, as Robert said, in 2020. Where do you think he'll land this time around? Is there any indication?
Well, I think about as well as he did in 2020, perhaps a little bit better, but well below, as Robert said, the way Republicans have generally performed Bush, and especially Romney, who's essentially a favorite son when he ran in 2012. So there's a segment of the Republican Party in Utah, 20-25% of the vote that are Republicans who would have voted for Romney, but vote for somebody other than Trump. And where they go, whether they skip, is going to be the question. And I think there's some elements of the national campaign that will provide cross pressure for that segment of the Republican base in Utah. And that's all of the Republicans that have come out, especially former cabinet officials and White House staff, nominal but clearly conservative Republicans, not just Liz Cheney, but several others, giving Republicans essentially permission to not vote for Trump and to vote for Harris because of what they see as the stakes of the election. I'll be watching to see if that has an effect that may boost Harris over where Biden was by 5 to 10 points, maybe.
I wanted to ask you guys about something that we've been working on, a show that explores the impact of Latter-day Saint women in Arizona, since it's this critical battleground state. And there's some thinking that women played an important role. Mormon women played an important role. It's hard to pin that down, actually, but that they might have played an important role in Joe Biden's support there in 2020, like really influential, obviously. And there's some interesting angles that I wanted to maybe ask you about for Mormon women in Utah. I'm not sure if there's a parallel here, but there's some sense that Latter-day Saint women in Arizona are not voting in the same way their husbands might be, and for various kinds of reasons. What do you all think about that idea? I'm not sure if you've explored this one really niche demographic, but what do you think about this?
I don't think we've explored the niche demographic, but looking at some of the things that have happened, you had an op-ed by Riverton Mayor Trent Staggs talking all about why Latter-day Saints should be voting for Donald Trump and should be feel comfortable voting for Donald Trump, specifically speaking to that demographic. And then as reporters were signed up for emails from the major parties, the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, the Utah GOP is organizing door-knocking trips to places like Arizona and Nevada. I wonder why they're specifically asking Utahns to go to these places when you have large populations of Latter-day Saints in both states. Could be something there. They're not saying it out loud, yeah, but that's kind of what I am surmising based on those things.
I was listening to the NPR Politics podcast yesterday, and they were talking about how Trump is very much so catered towards specifically men and has kind of lost the stake on women. And if we're like looking at Utah specifically, I'd be very curious to see a demographic breakdown to see the gender divide of who votes for who here. And so when it does come to the Mormon faith, where they have historically been very turned off by Trump's rhetoric and Trump's behavior, I don't think that that has changed within the last 4 years. I still, if anything, it maybe has grown. And so they are trying to, pun intended, trump up some support in these battleground states with a religion that has historically said, we don't really necessarily like vibe with you. And that's why I think like the third party candidate of Evan McMullen did give them, because they do believe in voting, right? Like the church has said, like, please be democratically engaged, please vote. And that gave them a candidate that they felt comfortable voting for if they didn't really fall in the Democratic tent and they didn't really fall in the Trump tent. And I do know like a handful of Mormon women that I've talked to, they're never Trumpers, right? They're casting their vote for Kamala Harris. So I do think that there may be a bump for Kamala Harris with Mormon women. And that could be detrimental for Trump in places like Arizona and Nevada that do have pretty large LDS populations.
David Magloy, have you tested this at all?
Yeah, Doug, I think what we're seeing with the LDS vote in Arizona and Nevada is a lot like what's happening with the African-American male vote nationally, which is Trump is trying to erode 3 to 5 to 6 points off of that vote from where it went with Biden to where it may go for him, or to get them to stay home, which has the same effect. And I think that's what's happening with the Mormon vote for Democrats. They're trying to narrow his margin with LDS voters in those two states. And I think there's reason to believe that Harris will have more success in 2024 than Biden did in 2020. And I think women will be a big part of that. But the three prominent figures that I think are helping mobilize LDS voters in Arizona are the Mesa mayor, Mayor Giles, who's a Republican and spoke at the Democratic National Convention. He has endorsed Harris. So has former Arizona Senator Jeff Flake. Both Mesa Mayor Giles and Flake are LDS.
Yeah.
Flake was a senator and congressman from Arizona. I think he has deep connections with many Republicans in Arizona. And I think he is playing in some ways the same role that Cheney and others are playing by saying, hey, it's okay. You won't lose your Temple recommend if you vote for Harris.
Yeah.
But the other figure that I will be watching to see if it has some effect is Rusty Bowers, the former Speaker of the Arizona House, who stood up to Trump in the aftermath of 2020 in a very brave and courageous way. And he's not been involved, to my knowledge, yet. But I think a lot of people in Arizona who are LDS know him. He was a very prominent figure, as I say, in the state legislature, clearly a strong conservative. But there's that dynamic going on in Arizona, which I think may change the dynamic this time, more with women than men, but I think with both.
But does it translate to Utah?
I don't think it translates much to Utah,
yeah.
but I think the same underlying anxiety or alienation that those voters feel towards Trump, which is perplexing for them, but they're Republicans, and they may never have voted for a Democrat. I mean, will lightning strike? And so if that's your mindset, then it could help translate to Utah. I think Utah Mormons are aware of Flake's endorsement. It's been reported here.
Yeah.
He's living in Utah now, post-ambassadorship to Turkey, and I think he's a leading candidate to be in a Harris cabinet.
David Magleby. He's a professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University. We also talked with Sage Miller and Sean Higgins. They're political reporters for KUER. They co-host the podcast State Street. And we also had Robert Gerke, a reporter with the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're reviewing the political landscape here in Utah as we head into the final weeks of the election season. You might be able to guess the outcome of many of the races in this thoroughly red state, but just how red is it looking in the future? We're talking about where Utah voting groups are these days, along with the races and the polling and the amendments. We have with us the senior political scientist David Magleby, along with the political journalists Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune and Sean Higgins and Sage Miller of KUER News. Okay, so I guess it sounds like we all agree the most interesting race probably in Utah is the race for governor. The Democratic candidate Brian King has a few days ago, a week ago or so, mentioned that he had gotten some really good internal polling that suggests he's kind of within striking distance, if you can consider 13 points.
Yeah.
If you squint, yeah. Yeah, that he's in striking distance of Utah Governor Cox. You all written about this. Robert Gerke, you start. What do you make of the – I want to get into the question of whether or not Cox's endorsement of Trump has alienated him with not just Republicans, but, you know, moderate Democrats who sometimes are inclined to vote for these moderate Republicans for governor. But what do you think generally?
Yeah, I mean, it's not a nail biter race right now.
Yeah.
Striking distance, you can perhaps close a few points. A large part of it depends on what percentage Phil Lyman polls. And it's hard to poll that because his name's not going to appear on the ballot. So you kind of have to give voters the option of adding that name when you're doing the polling. And, you know, so they had Phil up over 20%. I would be surprised if he gets near that much, which means where are those voters going to go? They're likely going to go to Cox. So I don't know that it's as close as maybe the poll makes it out to be, closer than we've seen gubernatorial races in the past. And the three-way dynamic makes it really interesting. I think that, you know, we have seen, if this number is accurate, which, again, you got to take internal polling with a grain of salt, Cox had a much larger lead before his endorsement. So that's probably the only indicator we have that this Trump endorsement has hurt him. And, yeah, if you think about it logically, the people who were going to vote for Phil Lyman weren't going to vote for Spencer Cox anyway.
Yeah.
And endorsing Trump isn't going to gain him any votes. And it's probably, if anything, going to lose him votes among those moderate anti-Trump voters.
So why did he do it?
Sage, you want to take that one?
So,
well, let me just say this. We talked to McKay Coppins about this from The Atlantic because he wrote an article specifically sort of going through why it was that Spencer Cox ended up endorsing Donald Trump. And there are a couple of things. I mean, he was on his way to church. Spencer Cox was when the assassination attempt happened, and he was moved to write this letter to Trump saying, hey, now's your chance to heal the country. You know, I think some would say fat chance that's going to happen. But the other part of the decision he made is interesting. He said, and it was kind of a practical thing, he said that he didn't want to be a Republican in exile. like Liz Cheney, like Mitt Romney, and in order to have a voice in the conversation and sort of petition Utahns and the rest of the world to be more civil and moderate, he had to be inside the tent, not outside the tent. So that was sort of the explanation that he had made. I don't know. What do you make of that?
I think kind of two things. I do think it's a spiritual aspect of it, and he felt moved to. The spirit called to him. And he acted on it. And when we asked him about this at the most recent governor's press conference about kind of his endorsement of Trump, he said that he did it as a form of like unity and wanting to bring everybody together as a sign of like, I am stepping with you, even though I have been against you. But additionally, he said this is not something he was doing to try and get the votes, and he doesn't always get it right. But he believes that this perhaps is, you know, an olive branch in order to maybe create some unification within a very divided Republican Party. And I also think that there has been speculation that Governor Cox will eventually move on from Utah and maybe go to a federal position. Some people have floated him maybe running for president, and him being in good graces with the former president of the leader of his party, that is probably not necessarily a bad thing to want to endorse him. But additionally, I think Gerke is right. If anything, this actually lost him votes in the election, which he is most likely going to win anyway. So I don't think he is really losing sleep over losing a handful of votes. But when we were putting together a voter panel, I called a handful of Republican voters, and I talked to one in southern Utah, and I asked her, you know, like, who are you planning on voting for governor? And she says, well, not Cox anymore because he did endorse Trump. And I have been campaigning for Cox, and I called his campaign and I told them to come pick up every single lawn sign I had that I was handing out to people because I am no longer working with him. So I do think that it was kind of a line in the sand that some people just aren't going to vote for Cox anymore. Do they bubble in Brian King? Maybe. Do they leave the race blank? Maybe. But I agree that I think that Cox is not going to win in a margin that we have seen other Republican governors win before.
If I could just add to that real quick, I have a little bit more of a cynical interpretation of it. After the assassination attempt, it looked like Donald Trump was going to coast to victory, and Joe Biden was still in the race at that point. It looked like
so he seized us. Cox
so
seized on that.
Saw the writing on the wall and thought, well, I would like to have a president who maybe is going to answer my phone calls when we need something for Utah, and so there's a political advantage for him to do that as well. Now, did he temper Donald Trump's rhetoric? It seems just the opposite. It seems like it's been more vitriolic, more hateful, more xenophobic in the last several weeks than it was back in July. So I think maybe Cox's grandiose ideas of, you know, moderating, unifying, tempering were ill-placed.
Okay, let's shift to the amendments, or at least one we can talk about, which is Amendment D, of course. The Utah Supreme Court voided Amendment D. Just as a reminder for those who need the reminder, the amendment would have given lawmakers this ability to repeal or change voter-approved ballot initiatives. Is it going to have any effect?
Yes.
Why?
I honestly think that maybe people just don't look at down ballot races anymore because the constitutional amendments were going to be on the back of your ballot, right? Because it's just a very long ballot. Do your research. You're going to have judges.
There's a voter guide.
Yeah, there's like so much stuff happening. I don't know if people are going to look at their whole ballot anymore if they're aware about Amendment D and Amendment A now being voided. And I also think that Amendment D, more so than Amendment A, but people were very riled up about Amendment A too, kind of motivated people to want to vote because they were very mad. And they weren't just mad about the amendment. They were mad about the people who also got the amendment on the ballot in the first place. And so there was kind of some amped up emotions to want to vote them out too, or wanting to kind of pound the pavement on that issue as well. And now, since that technically, I mean, quite frankly, those amendments were the most juicy part of the ballot.
Yep.
And now the juicy part is now gone. So I think that affects voter turnout, and I think that affects people finishing their entire ballot.
So they're not pissed off in the same way. Will they turn out? Do you think that's the way to think about it?
Yeah. I mean, I think anger is a pretty powerful motivator in politics. And so having those no longer count, I think, is going to diminish that some. I think people are still upset. I think people still remember. And from candidates I've been talking to, they get asked about it a lot. And it cut across party lines, as we talked about in the last show we did about this. Republicans and Democrats didn't like it. And so it had the potential to be a real liability. plus, had it stayed on the ballot, you'd have several million dollars pumped into both the Amendment D and Amendment A campaigns for and against, which means it would have been, you know, it would have been all over the airwaves and people would have known all about it. Having it taken off, I think, as Sage said, throws a little bit of water on that. But I still think that there is an undercurrent. We don't know how big it is, right? But there is this undercurrent of people who are going to, you know, go to the ballot box to punish the Republicans who passed this thing.
Hmm. I think, like Sage said, this is going to have some impact to the degree of which people are still angry and just want the satisfaction of checking the box one way or another for Amendment A or Amendment D. I don't think it will change the races at the top of the ticket, but particularly when you get to more local races, I'm thinking specifically Salt Lake County, where you have two very competitive, very consequential races in county mayor and county council. That could have a huge impact, I think, if people are not physically flipping that ballot over when they know that, oh, that thing that I really wanted to vote on the last page isn't there anymore.
David McAvely, is that what they do? It seems like they did all the work just opening the thing in the first place and, you know, being showing up. Do they just not care about that the other end of the ballot?
Well, there is a thing called ballot fatigue. It's not experienced in Utah as much as in, say, just home state of Oregon or especially in California, where this would be a very short ballot for any of those voters. They would call it a vacation. in Utah, we have much less drop-off. In California, it can reach to 20-25% of the vote that turn out, vote for president, vote for senator, house, whatever, but then stop voting. They tend to come back and find Amendment A or Amendment D if those had been contested and funded. What I'm watching for, though, is different, and I don't know that we'll get a harbinger of this in this cycle, but there's a lot of anger on the other side, the pro-Amendment A and D side, towards judges. And Justice Durant is on the ballot this time. He's the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court that took D off the ballot or upheld the decision of the district court to take it off the ballot. I don't think there was enough time this cycle to organize an opposition campaign to Justice Durant. But I think it's worth watching for in the future. And those of you with Salt Lake ballots can tell me if the district court judges in either case were on the ballot this time. They are not on my ballot. And so I'm not sure whether they're up now. But if they're not up now, they will be up in the future. And several of those legislators are hopping mad about the courts. And one way to deal with it is to organize an opposition campaign to a Supreme Court justice like Durant, who voted with the unanimous Supreme Court on Amendment D.
That's the political scientist David Magleby. We also had with us Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune and KUER's own Sean Higgins and Sage Miller. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking politics on the show today. Despite all the agita on the national political scene, there probably won't be many surprises after the votes are cast this year in Utah. Our guests for the show have been paying attention to what happens on the margins, whether it will say something about change in the future. Robert Gerke of the Salt Lake Tribune is back with us, along with Sage Miller and Sean Higgins of KUER News, and the political scientist David Magleby. I want to shift to legislative races, and I'm not sure there are going to be any upsets or surprises that you're all anticipating, although there may be. I think the thing that's interesting about this segment or this section are all the independents, which seems to be unique. Robert, you've been writing about this. In most years, you say in your writing an average of about two Utah candidates run as independents. This year, there's just like 13 or something like that. Like, what do you make of all of that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it was calculated. Part of it was people looked at what Evan McMullen did against Mike Lee, looked at the totals in certain districts. identified candidates who could run in those districts and recruited candidates to run as independents in those districts. And it's, so it's, this is not just something that happened. It's not an organic thing, but there are some of these seats where there's a good chance that the independent could pull it out. I mean, down in Provo, Lori Spruance is running against Kevin Stratton, the Democrat who was in that race, dropped out and endorsed her. And that seems like a red area, but it's an area that is, you know, around campus. It's more liberal than most of the rest of the city. Jessica Wignall is running against Ken Ivory. Ken, from what I'm hearing, is in a lot of trouble in that race. And Monica Manuel may be able to pull off an upset against Wayne Harper. She's raised a decent amount of money for a challenger. Harper's been there for a long time. And so these independents, they're not just running, they actually have a legitimate shot at winning. And, you know, when Amendment D was still in play, I was talking to, you know, political insiders who were thinking that as many as 9 seats could flip this year. Mm-hmm. I think that's optimistic or overly ambitious. But I think it's likely that we'll see at least a handful of seats flip. One of them that I'm watching is up in northern Utah. Stacey Bernal is running against Senator John Johnson, who's a pretty polarizing figure. Bernal is a fairly moderate Democrat and you know, a good candidate. So there's a handful of seats that I think, despite the lack of drama at the top of the ticket, there could be some things shaking up at the bottom.
Do you think it's a reflection of this kind of maybe frustration among mainstream but moderate Utah voters over a two-party system?
I think yes. I think there's a little bit of an identity crisis with the Utah GOP happening, especially right now, but certainly it started, I think, 8 years ago when Donald Trump first came onto the scene, where you see many lawmakers, I think Spencer Cox is the prime example of it, walking this very crooked tightrope between playing nice and calling out things they may see as objectionable. And I think when we look at the state legislature, they are much more in the they've been talking to a lot of Republican delegates, I'll say that, as opposed to day-to-day Republican voters in the state. And I think if, and it's a fairly decently big if, Democrats do pick up a good number of seats, it won't affect the voting dynamics of the legislature. But I do think it sends a pretty strong message to Speaker Schultz and President Adams. Speaker Schultz, especially in his first year as Speaker, had a very aggressive agenda that he got accomplished and some very polarizing legislation when you look at things like transgender bathroom access, DEI legislation, things that made a lot of more Republican voters a little uncomfortable to see. And I think if this does happen and Democrats do pick up seats, it could temper it. I think it sends a message. Whether the message is received and internalized, I think, is another question. But I think I would love to be inside the mind of legislative leadership for a day after the election, if this goes down.
Well, and if I could, if 2 votes in the Senate would have made Amendment D moot, because they need 2/3 of the votes. They got all from Republicans. If there had been 2 seats that had flipped, Amendment D wouldn't have been a thing, right? We've seen that a lot of times with these so-called veto-proof majorities. If they can get to 2/3, then, you know, the legislature wields a lot more power. You chip off a few seats here or there, a couple in the House, 1 or 2 in the Senate, and that supermajority starts to become pretty tenuous. And so, yeah, I agree with Sean. I think it could, you know, it's not going to change the legislature. Republicans will still run the place and, you know, have a supermajority. But is it enough to get those to override the governor's veto, to put constitutional amendments on the ballot, that sort of thing. And so, yeah, I'm also watching for the margins on these too, because I think there is frustration with the two-party system in a lot of ways, or you know, and I think Evan McMullen tried to tap into that and he did a reasonably good job of it. And so I think if we get a strong signal from these independent candidates, it could be something that more try to replicate in the future. One more I wanted to mention. Yeah. Running for attorney general is a third party candidate, Michelle Quist,
right,
who is mounting a pretty she's working hard, you know. And so I think that's another one I'm going to watch for, to see where is the temperature of the electorate right now.
Well, David Magleby, what would a frustrated Utah voter? They're frustrated about the supermajority in the legislature. They're frustrated about the rhetoric, about the two-party system. It seems like a step too far for some to actually vote for a Democrat right now. So would they consider being an independent? Like, what do you make of the sense of independence, which Utahns always tend to think of themselves as independents and then generally vote Republican, don't they?
Yes, they do. But I think the underlying problem, Doug, is to run as an independent, you are missing the infrastructure and support base that a political party can give and should give. But the Democratic Party in Utah, outside of Salt Lake County and a few other places, is pretty moribund. And so that party needs to be reactivated and rejuvenated, and some victories would help. But that may take a while. I think what we saw in 2018 was a harbinger of what we've seen since, with the passage of the ballot initiatives. And it's not just the redistricting gerrymandering one that then led to Amendment D for this year, but it's the Medicaid expansion and so forth. And those other measures signaled, I think, a pretty strong majority, that is to say over 50%, essentially voting against their state legislature and saying, we want a different dynamic. But they lack a party mechanism to express that and make that happen, I think, outside of Salt Lake County. And so it'll be interesting to see what happens in Salt Lake County, where there is a more active party. And as others have mentioned, there are some viable candidates. But I think we may see some more initiatives that what Amendment D and the passage of the 2018 initiatives did was say, hey, we've got one tool that we can use to try and change structure and policy, things like Medicaid expansion. So I'm not so sure we won't see some ballot initiatives to counter the legislature yet again as we go to 2026.
Does this plug in, Sage and Sean, to some of the work you're doing, sort of exploring whether or not Utah could get purple in the future, if the not so distant future?
I think as you look at the voters who are aging out of the population and the voters who are now coming into kind of that prime voting age population, they are statistically more progressive than generations before them. And the people we have talked to through our reporting through State Street have indicated that there's really no markers right now that says they will become more conservative as they get older. There are these kind of seminal moments as you grow up and form your political identities. I think the comparison was made with Gen X being a little bit more conservative is because they came of age during Ronald Reagan being this mercurial figure in the Republican Party, whereas millennials and Gen Z, millennials grew up with or became voters with Obama as president. And then Gen Z had this figure in Donald Trump who was particularly in the context of conservatism in Utah with the influence of the Latter-day Saint Church, morally reprehensible to a lot of people who grew up being told that Republican Party had the high ground on a lot of these moral issues. And then you have a figure that is supposedly leading the party going to the antithesis of those moral values that you have been raised in. So I think as we move into the future and as these younger voters become more involved, I said earlier that I'm not convinced that they are deep blue liberals. I think they are more in that moderate to purple range.
Mm-hmm. People that we've talked to, specifically young voters, I think that they're kind of just turned off by politics in general. And it goes back to what Gerke was saying with the Utah Priorities Project of lawmakers not listening to the voter. And when we've talked to young people, they don't care about the social or the culture wars. They want their bodies out of the conversation, and they don't care about what bathrooms people are using. They care about housing affordability. They care about the economy. They care about being able to their health care, child care, these issues that politicians are not talking about. And if they are, it's very surface level. So for them to get out and vote, they need to be for them to get out and vote and even want to engage in politics, politicians, whoever messages them first, right? Whoever's actually talking to them about the issues and how they can actually improve their life rather than what they believe is morally reprehensible or morally acceptable, I think is going to have the upper hand here, which I believe is why, like, people are just really, really turned off. We heard that with a young Republican voter who was running against Mike Kennedy at convention, where he was like, some of the most gracious and interesting and complex conversations I had were with young voters, and was specifically just about policy, because, like, that's what they want to talk about. And the political landscape of who is elected right now are just not doing that. They're not cutting it. And so I think it really does come down to whoever starts messaging better and who gets away from the surface level conversations and starts actually breaking down how they can help their lives. Because my generation is not doing great. We're not very well off. A lot of us still lean on our parents, and we don't want that for the rest of our life. We don't see any other way out.
All right. I want to shift to some final thoughts. I'm wondering, and this is a question none of you can necessarily answer, but because one of the questions is, will there be violence on election day? Will there be some kind of voter suppression? Will, you know, voting officials be intimidated? I guess the question you can answer is, what do you think about that? And is Utah's election system relatively stable compared to Georgia or Arizona? Like, what do you make of that? How are you thinking about that question, I guess, if you are? David Magleby, you first.
Well, I worry about that a great deal, more elsewhere than in Utah. But my grandson and I were at the county clerk's office yesterday with him turning in his voter registration form. He's just turned 18.
Woo!
And one of the workers there, as we rode the elevator down, I said, thank you for doing this. You really are heroes. There's a sign outside the door. Heroes work here. And that's true. I said, you are heroes. Thank you for doing it. She said, well, we had a training today on bomb threats.
Wow.
This is in Utah County.
Yeah.
It was sobering to me. And we know that there's worries about that. The laws have been changed in many states to the effect that I think voters could be intimidated and harassed. There could be people standing in the polling places for in-person voting that are packing heat, etc. So we had tastes of that in 2020 with some skirmishes, but we didn't have as much of it. Then, of course, we had January 6th. So it is very clear nationally that they're struggling to get poll workers, and that many of these offices in places like Georgia, Arizona, and so forth, are really worried about the safety and protection of election workers. So the answer is, we all should be worried about this, and we should thank those who serve.
Yeah, I'm with David. David, I think it's likely that there's going to be, especially in states that are hotly contested, intimidation tactics. But it's going to trickle down here. I mean, we've already seen letters sent to the lieutenant governor's office here with white powder in them, sent to many states across the country. The conspiracy theories that are fed by people like Phil Lyman and others that the election's going to be stolen, it puts in people's minds that they're right to try to defend the electoral process. Mm-hmm. And in doing so, they're actually undermining the process. You know, I think in the past we've had what has been pointed to as a model of election systems in this state. And we had advocates for that election system in Gary Herbert and Spencer Cox and now Lieutenant Governor Henderson, who defended it and promoted it. But now it's a lot harder. I think there's a lot more scrutiny. There's a lot more malevolence directed toward it, less trust in it, more people who benefit from undermining those electoral processes. So I think there could be some of it here, but I agree with David that those other states, it's going to be a circus. I mean, there's real potential for violence. There's potential for intimidation. These, you know, and it's an ugly, ugly thing, especially when things don't go the way that one candidate wants it.
I think in Utah, we're going to be pretty tame. I think that the most of the vitriol and the violence is going to be through Twitter and more so that than actual action on the ground. I know that some county clerks have security measures in place, but most of them, or all of them, you know, welcome people to come observe the process as they're counting ballots and whatnot. But they have seen an uptick in hateful rhetoric towards them. I also wonder how this conversation evolves if Trump wins. Does it dissipate? Is it done? Do Democrats now take over the narrative? I don't know. But it is something to look for.
I think I'm most worried about the spillover from other parts of the country influencing the conversation that does happen in the immediate aftermath of the election here. I think looking back to 2020, in Utah, it was a pretty predictable election. The people who we thought were going to win beforehand, by and large, won. So, but you still had this huge push to reform the way Utah does its elections. And you had election officials who have done this for their entire careers speaking until they're blue in the face about how Utah's system is secure. And we had a cohort of influential politicians say, sure, but we're hearing that people are really worried about this, so we need to address X, Y, and Z. And then we had this slew of election-related bills to further refine the process or trying to make it a little bit more transparent. And I think, to Sage's point, if Kamala Harris wins, I think the rhetoric will be ratcheted up in Utah, and we may see some more efforts at the legislative level to address election security. I don't think we'll get mass demonstrations in Utah. I think the most competitive area of the state this election is Salt Lake County. The candidates on both sides that I have spoken with are not the election denial type. So I think if any of that does happen, they'll be pretty quick to tell everyone to go home that I'm not into contesting this the way you're into contesting this. But I do think that if Donald Trump does win, what happens now? Like, did you get what you wanted? Are you the dog that caught the car? Like, where does this conversation go after this?
Final question. Turnout, what do you think?
I think it'll be lower than 2020, but I do think Donald Trump will underperform his numbers from 2020 in Utah, because the conversations I have had with more moderate Republicans, certainly with Democrats, there's a lot of enthusiasm around Kamala Harris.
I think it's going to be pretty standard. And I think it probably would have been higher if we did have Amendment A and Amendment D on the ballot. But now that we don't, the people who don't care about politics and they care about how their direct legislation is being impacted, I think it hurts it more than harms it.
I think it'll be lower. I think Sean's right. But I think, you know, we usually do pretty well in terms of turnout nationally, because we do have this vote by mail system in place. And I think what's going to be interesting is how that turnout materializes and what that means for some of these competitive races in Salt Lake County. There's three races for the council. The Zach Robinson, Dia Theodore one is the one that I think most people are watching most closely. And that could flip the council back to Democratic control, which would be a significant change.
David Magleby, final thought.
Well, competition is what drives turnout, and we don't have much in Utah, and we don't have much this year. So I think it will be about where it's been. But that's a big drop from where it once was. Utah used to be in the top three states nationally, competing with states like North Dakota, which does not have voter registration. And talking in the 50s, 60s, and into the 70s. And so what happened that led a state that was very proud of being a national leader in turnout to being one that's kind of in the middle? And the answer is an absence of competition. And that, Doug, I think speaks to your earlier question about whether the state might turn purple. It is the absence of competition that leads to these independent candidacies rather than running as Democrats. It's the gerrymandering that leads to non-competitive U.S. House races. There should be one of those four House races that's likely Democratic or at least competitive. None of them are. And that's as a result of partisan gerrymandering, which, of course, led to the ballot initiative and to Amendment D. So when districts become more competitive, then I think voters will say, hey, my vote matters more. And the other thing that I think hasn't happened is the Democrats have to be a party of opportunism. That's how Bill Orton got three terms in the U.S. House from a very conservative congressional district in Utah. And I think they've missed an opportunity in 2024 in the attorney general's race. We've had a series of scandalous attorneys general, and Democrats, I think, had a chance to finally win one. And when you win a race, then you can build partisan infrastructure. You can build voter lists. You can recruit volunteers that will come back next time, too. And they haven't had that.
David Magleby, he's a professor emeritus of political science at Brigham Young University. Robert Gerke is with the Salt Lake Tribune. He also joined us along with KUER's political reporters Sage Miller and Sean Higgins. They're also co-hosts of the podcast State Street. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're on YouTube at KUER90.1, and you can email us at radiowest@kuer.org. Our intern is Stevie Shaughnessy, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.